This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Gordon Mackenzie. Scaramouche, A Romance of the French Revolution by Raphael Sabatini. Chapter 8. Omnes Omnibus. André Louis rode forth from Rennes, committed to a deeper adventure than he had dreamed when he left the sleepy village of Gavriac. Lying the night at a roadside inn, and setting out again early in the morning, he reached Nantes soon after noon of the following day. Through that long and lonely ride, through the dull plains of Brittany, now at their dreariest in their winter garb, he had ample leisure in which to review his actions and his position. From one who had taken hitherto a purely academic and by no means friendly interest in the new philosophies of social life, exercising his wits upon these new ideas merely as a fencer exercises his eye and wrist with the foils, without ever suffering himself to be deluded into supposing the issue a real one, he found himself suddenly converted into a revolutionary firebrand, committed to revolutionary action of the most desperate kind. The representative and delegate of a nobleman in the States of Brittany, he found himself simultaneously and incongruously the representative and delegate of the whole Third Estate of Rennes. It is difficult to determine to what extent, in the heat of passion, and swept along by the torrent of his own oratory, he might yesterday have succeeded in deceiving himself. But it is at least certain that, looking back in cold blood now, he had no single delusion on the score of what he had done. Cynically he had presented to his audience one side only of the great question that he propounded. But since the established order of things in France was such as to make a rampart for Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr, affording him complete immunity for this and any other crimes that it pleased him to commit, why, then the established order must take the consequences of its wrongdoing. Therein he perceived his clear justification. And so it was, without misgivings, that he came on his errand of sedition into that beautiful city of Nantes, rendered its spacious streets and splendid port the rival in prosperity of Bordeaux and Marseille. He found an inn on the Quai La Fosse, where he put up his horse, and where he dined in the embrasure of a window that looked out over the tree-bordered quay and the broad bosom of the Loire, on which argosies of all nations rode at anchor. The sun had again broken through the clouds and shed its pale wintry light over the yellow waters and the tall masted shipping. Along the quays there was a stir of life as great as that to be seen on the quays of Paris. Foreign sailors in outlandish garments and of harsh-sounding outlandish speech, stalwart fishwives with baskets of herrings on their heads, voluminous of petticoat above bare legs and bare feet, calling their wares shrilly and almost inarticulately. Watermen in woolen caps and loose trousers rolled to the knees. Peasants in goatskin coats, their wooden shoes clattering on the round kidney stones. Shipwrights and laborers from the dockyards, bellows menders, rat catchers, water carriers, ink sellers, and other itinerant peddlers. And sprinkled through this proletariat mass that came and went in constant movement, André Louis beheld tradesmen in sober garments, merchants in long fur-lined coats, occasionally a merchant prince rolling along in his two-horse cabriolet to the whip-crackings and shouts of "Gare!" from his coachman. Occasionally a dainty lady carried past in her sedan-chair, with perhaps a mincing abbé from the episcopal court tripping along in attendance. Occasionally an officer in scarlet riding disdainfully, and once the great carriage of a nobleman, with escutcheoned panels and a pair of white-stockinged powdered footmen in gorgeous liveries hanging on behind. And there were Capuchins in brown and Benedictines in black, and secular priests in plenty, for God was well served in the 16 parishes of Nantes. And by way of contrast, there were lean-jawed, out-at-elbow adventurers, and gendarmes in blue coats and gaitered legs, sauntering guardians of the peace. Representatives of every class that went to make up the 70,000 inhabitants of that wealthy, industrious city were to be seen in the human stream that ebbed and flowed beneath the window from which André Louis observed it. Of the waiter who ministered to his humble wants with soup and bouilli and a measure of vin gris, André Louis inquired into the state of public feeling in the city. The waiter, a staunch supporter of the privileged orders, admitted regretfully that an uneasiness prevailed. Much would depend upon what happened at Rennes. If it was true that the king had dissolved the states of Brittany, then all should be well, and the malcontents would have no pretext for further disturbances. There had been trouble and to spare in Nantes already. They wanted no repetition of it. All manner of rumors were abroad, and since early morning there had been crowds besieging the portals of the Chamber of Commerce for definite news. But definite news was yet to come. It was not even known for a fact that His Majesty actually had dissolved the States. It was striking, too, the busiest hour of the day upon the Bourse, when André Louis reached the Place du Commerce. The square, dominated by the imposing classical building of the Exchange, was so crowded that he was compelled almost to fight his way through to the steps of the magnificent Ionic porch. A word would have sufficed to have opened a way for him at once, but guile moved him to keep silent. He would come upon that waiting multitude as a thunderclap, precisely as yesterday he had come upon the mob at Rennes. He would lose nothing of the surprise effect of his entrance. The precincts of that house of commerce were jealously kept by a line of ushers armed with staves, a guard as hurriedly assembled by the merchants as it was evidently necessary. One of these now effectively barred the young lawyer's passage as he attempted to mount the steps. André Louis announced himself in a whisper. The stave was instantly raised from the horizontal, and he passed and went up the steps in the wake of the usher. At the top, on the threshold of the chamber, he paused and stayed his guide. "I will wait here," he announced. "Bring the president to me." "Your name, monsieur?" Almost had André Louis answered him when he remembered Le Chapelier's warning of the danger with which his mission was fraught, and Le Chapelier's parting admonition to conceal his identity. "My name is unknown to him. It matters nothing. I am the mouthpiece of a people, no more. Go." The usher went, and in the shadow of that lofty pillared portico André Louis waited, his eyes straying out ever and anon to survey that spread of upturned faces immediately below him. Soon the president came, others following, crowding out into the portico, jostling one another in their eagerness to hear the news. "You are a messenger from Rennes?" "I am the delegate sent by the literary chamber of that city to inform you here in Nantes of what is taking place."
"Your name?"
André Louis paused. "The less we mention names, perhaps the better." The president's eyes grew big with gravity. He was a corpulent, florid man, purse-proud and self-sufficient. He hesitated a moment. Then, "Come into the chamber," said he. "By your leave, monsieur," I will deliver my message from here, from these steps.
From here? The great merchant frowned. My message is for the people of Nantes, and from here I can speak at once to the greatest number of Nantais of all ranks. And it is my desire, and the desire of those whom I represent, that as great a number as possible should hear my message at first hand.
Tell me, sir, is it true that the king has dissolved the states?
André Louis looked at him. He smiled apologetically, and waved a hand towards the crowd, which by now was straining for a glimpse of this slim young man who had brought forth the president, and more than half the numbers of the chamber, guessing already with that curious instinct of crowds that he was the awaited bearer of tidings.
"Summon the gentlemen of your chamber, monsieur," said he, "and you shall hear all."
"So be it."
A word, and forth they came to crowd upon the steps, but leaving clear the topmost step and a half-moon space in the middle. To the spot so indicated, André Louis now advanced very deliberately. He took his stand there, dominating the entire assembly. He removed his hat and launched the opening bombshell of that address, which is historic, marking as it does one of the great stages of France's progress towards revolution.
"People of this great city of Nantes, I have come to summon you to arms."
In the amazed and rather scared silence that followed, he surveyed them for a moment before resuming.
"I am a delegate of the people of Rennes, charged to announce to you what is taking place, and to invite you in this dreadful hour of our country's peril to rise and march to her defense."
"Name! Your name!"
a voice shouted, and instantly the cry was taken up by others until the multitude rang with the question. He could not answer that excited mob as he had answered the president. It was necessary to compromise, and he did so happily.
"My name," said he, "is Omnis Omnibus, all for all. Let that suffice for now. I am a herald, a mouthpiece, a voice, no more. I come to announce to you that since the privileged orders assembled for the states of Brittany and Rennes resisted your will, our will, despite the king's plain hint to them, His Majesty has dissolved the states." There was a burst of delirious applause. Men laughed and shouted, and cries of "Vive le roi!" rolled forth like thunder. André Louis waited, and gradually the preternatural gravity of his countenance came to be observed, and to beget the suspicion that there might be more to follow. Gradually silence was restored, and at last André Louis was able to proceed.
"You rejoice too soon. Unfortunately, the nobles, in their insolent arrogance, have elected to ignore the royal dissolution, and in despite of it persist in sitting and in conducting matters as seems good to them."
A silence of utter dismay greeted that disconcerting epilogue to the announcement that had been so rapturously received. André Louis continued after a moment's pause.
"So that these men, who were already rebels against the people, rebels against justice and equity, rebels against humanity itself, are now also rebels against their king. Sooner than yield an inch of the unconscionable privileges by which too long already they have flourished, to the misery of a whole nation, they will make a mock of royal authority, hold up the king himself to contempt. They are determined to prove that there is no real sovereignty in France, but the sovereignty of their own parasitic fainéantise.
There was a faint splutter of applause, but the majority of the audience remained silent, waiting.
"This is no new thing. Always has it been the same. No minister in the last 10 years who, seeing the needs and perils of the state, counseled the measures that we now demand as the only means of arresting our motherland in its ever-quickening progress to the abyss, but found himself as a consequence cast out of office by the influence which privilege brought to bear against him. Twice already has Monsieur Necker been called to the ministry, to be twice dismissed when his insistent counsels of reform threatened the privileges of clergy and nobility. For the third time now he has been called to office, and at last it seems we are to have States General in spite of privilege. But what the privileged orders can no longer prevent, they are determined to stultify. Since it is now a settled thing that these States General are to meet, at least the nobles and the clergy will see to it, unless we take measures to prevent them, by packing the Third Estate with their own creatures and denying it all effective representation. They convert the States General into an instrument of their own will for the perpetuation of abuses by which they live. To achieve this end, they will stop at nothing. They have flouted the authority of the king, and they are silencing by assassination those who raise their voices to condemn them. Yesterday in Rennes, 2 young men who addressed the people as I am addressing you were done to death in the streets by assassins at the instigation of the nobility. Their blood cries out for vengeance. Beginning in a sullen mutter, the indignation that moved his hearers swelled up to express itself in a roar of anger. "Citizens of Nantes, the motherland is in peril. Let us march to her defense. Let us proclaim it to the world that we recognize that the measures to liberate the Third Estate from the slavery in which for centuries it has groaned find only obstacles in those orders whose frenetic egotism sees in the tears and suffering of the unfortunate an odious tribute which they would pass on to their generation still unborn. Realizing from the barbarity of the means employed by our enemies to perpetuate our oppression that we have everything to fear from the aristocracy they would set up as a constitutional principle for the governing of France, let us declare ourselves at once enfranchised from it. The establishment of liberty and equality should be the aim of every citizen member of the Third Estate, and to this end we should stand indivisibly united, especially the young and vigorous, especially those who have had the good fortune to be born late enough to be able to gather for themselves the precious fruits of the philosophy of this 18th century. Acclamations broke out unstintedly now. He had caught them in the snare of his oratory, and he pressed his advantage instantly. "Let us all swear," he cried in a great voice, "to raise up in the name of humanity and of liberty a rampart against our enemies, to oppose to their bloodthirsty covetousness the calm perseverance of men whose cause is just. And let us protest here and in advance against any tyrannical decrees that should declare us seditious when we have none but pure and just intentions. Let us make oath upon the honor of our motherland that should any of us be seized by an unjust tribunal, intending against us one of those acts termed of political expediency, which are in fact but acts of despotism. Let us swear, I say, to give a full expression to the strength that is in us, and do that in self-defense, which nature, courage, and despair dictate to us.
Loud and long rolled the applause that greeted his conclusion, and he observed with satisfaction, and even some inward grim amusement, that the wealthy merchants who had been congregated upon the steps, and who now came crowding about him to shake him by the hand and to acclaim him, were not merely participants in, but the actual leaders of, this delirium of enthusiasm. It confirmed him, had he needed confirmation, in his conviction that just as the philosophies upon which this new movement was based had their source in thinkers extracted from the bourgeoisie, so the need to adopt those philosophies to the practical purposes of life was most acutely felt at present by those bourgeois who found themselves debarred by privilege from the expansion their wealth permitted them. If it might be said of André Louis that he had that day lighted the torch of the revolution in Nantes, it might, with even greater truth, be said that the torch itself was supplied by the opulent bourgeoisie. I need not dwell at any length upon the sequel. It is a matter of history how that oath which Omnes Omnibus administered to the citizens of Nantes formed the backbone of the formal protest which they drew up and signed in their thousands. Nor were the results of that powerful protest, which, after all, might already be said to harmonize with the expressed will of the sovereign himself, long delayed. Who shall say how far it may have strengthened the hand of Necker, when on the 27th of that same month of November he compelled the council to adopt the most significant and comprehensive of all those measures to which clergy and nobility had refused their consent. On that date was published the royal decree ordaining that the deputies to be elected to the States General should number at least 1,000, and that the deputies of the Third Estate should be fully representative by numbering as many as the deputies of clergy and nobility together. End of chapter 8.